change.
Welcome, friends, and thank you as always to John Lee Hooker and Carlos Santana for reminding us so beautifully that change is coming. And indeed, today's program is going to be about change, probably more than anything else. This is Economic Update, and my name is Richard Wolff. I'm your host. I've been a professor of economics all my life at several universities. Currently, I earn my income teaching as a visiting professor in the Graduate Program for International Affairs of the New School University in New York City. And I also write columns of economic analysis for the website truthout.org, a courageous source of independent news, news analysis, and commentary every day. Please keep sending in your questions and comments. We read every single one. We select a few that we can respond to on the air, and the rest we use to shape the contents that we organize for each program. You can send your questions and comments to either of our two websites, the one that I have always told you about, rdwolff.com, and that's the website that carries all of my work if you're interested, and the other website, a new one that's some months old, is just as available to you. It's called democracyatwork.info. It is a new website that assembles everything you might like to know about workers' self-directed enterprises, about economic democracy, about cooperatives, and the importance of these things to our future. So send your comments and questions to me either at rdwolff.com or at democracyatwork.info. And if you're willing for us to use your name on the air, please let us know. Before I introduce my guest, who will be discussing Occupy Wall Street and its significance, in a sense, a year after it surged into prominence in the United States, before we get to that, I want to turn to some related shorter items, as we usually do on Economic Update. The first one is a big one, and I want to introduce it. The way the capitalist economic system works includes the decisions by capitalist enterprises when it's profitable to leave an area where they have long been located and go somewhere else. In recent decades, where they've gone is to places where labor is cheaper, where they can get away with paying workers less than where they have been located. The most dramatic example here in the United States would be cities like Detroit or Cleveland or Camden, New Jersey, places that were once thriving industrial centers but that were abandoned by capitalist corporations located there when they thought they could make more money someplace else. So car companies went to Mexico from Detroit, to Canada from Detroit, to the American South, from Detroit. For the places they went to, it meant jobs and rising income. For the places they left, collapse, destitution. A visit to Detroit, Cleveland, or Camden today will tell you more than all the words I could ever sum up about the devastation that can flood and flow from capitalist decisions. Now imagine that what is happening is no longer leaving this or that city. Imagine if the movement of capitalists to make more money becomes not a matter of urban areas, but of entire continents. Think North America and Western Europe. Think of capitalist independence, if you like, freedom of enterprise, as meaning you can shut your factories in France or Germany, in Italy or Spain, in Ohio or Tennessee, and move instead to the much lower wages you can pay in China, in India, and in countless other places. Then the devastation of the city can become the devastation of entire nations, and indeed of entire continents. Such is the way capitalism works. Here in the West, this movement has been underway for quite a while. The United States and Western Europe have been suffering. One of the reasons the business downturn that began in 2007 and 8 has proven not to be as short-lived as many hoped and too many predicted, but has been deep and long-lasting with no end in sight, is because it is happening at a time when capitalists are abandoning the United States and Western Europe in stunning proportions. And that means suffering, and that means devastation. Again, the model would be Detroit or Cleveland or Camden, New Jersey. And there are some parts of North America and Europe which are showing the abandonment in an extreme form, just as Detroit did and does. One of the places where the abandonment by capitalism of its former home is stark is the entire country of Greece. There is a devastation going on there on a scale that is truly stunning and something no one could have imagined had they not been aware of this situation, which most weren't, as little as 3 and 4 years ago. Over the last 2.5 years, the average income of workers in Greece has dropped by one-third. One-third. The level of struggle and suffering there is unimaginable. Athens was described to me yesterday at a meeting I went to at the Graduate Center of the City of New York as a devastated ghost city. There are daily attacks on immigrants by people who think they're at fault for what is in fact a normal, unfortunately normal, process of capitalism. And there have been strikes. In the last week, a stunning strike in the middle of Athens. The subway system that moves, together with the buses and trolleys, more than 1 million people every day, commuters in and out of Athens, Greece's number one city. They went on strike when they were told they would need to suffer another 25% cut in their income. And the government reacted by basically drafting them into the military, imposing on them a militarization which made them temporarily soldiers, such that they then had to obey the law and the order of their superiors. They weren't in fact soldiers. They weren't in the army. They were just militarized so that an order could be given, you must go back to work. And if they violated it, they could be arrested and thrown in jail for having violated the order of a superior in the military, even though it wasn't the military. There's a law on the books in Greece and in many other countries, by the way, that permits the government in emergencies to do this. Well, the subway workers went back to work, but they were mighty angry. So angry that they made an appeal to the bus drivers and the trolleys. Those are very important in Athens. And so they went out on strike in sympathy, keeping the transportation system shut down. This is a situation in which the working people of Greece are engaged really in what is so loosely called in the United States class war. It is a war of the wealthy and the corporations and the governing parties in Greece on the one hand, against the entire working class, the majority of Greek citizens, who are being savaged as the price to pay for the freedom of capitalist enterprises to move to wherever they can make greater profits. But in Greece, there is a difference. Something has happened in Greece that did not happen in Detroit or in Cleveland or in Camden. The people are fighting back, and one of the mechanisms, besides their strikes and besides their demonstrations, and Greece has had more of those in the last 3 years than in the previous 20. The other thing they do is organize politically, organize electorally. They have a new political party, Syriza. And I want to end by telling you about it, and partly because the leaders of that party have been visiting the United States over recent days to explain what they're doing. First, here is a political party that takes an uncompromising stand against austerity. No more cutting people's wages. Return them to what they were. No more savaging the average people. A completely different solution has to be found for this crisis. It is not going to be allowed to savage Greece the way the similar developments savaged Detroit, Cleveland, and Camden. And look at what happened when a political party arose with the courage to say that. Having been a very small marginal party, getting 2-3% of the vote over several election cycles, in 2012, as this savage austerity, and that's the name of this destruction, it's the name in Greece, it's a name in Europe, it should have been the name in Cleveland and Detroit too. As this gained steam, so did this party. Its uncompromising stand zoomed it up from 2-3% of the vote to currently getting 27-28% of the vote and having a very good chance in the next election to be the number one political party. It is now at least number two, and it's touch and go whether it will be number one and therefore become the next government in Greece. So when someone says you can't organize politically or electorally around these issues, Syriza in Greece begs to differ and proves the contrary. And it suggests something which we're going to come back to in the interview today when we're going to look at Occupy Wall Street and think about it in relationship to the very different kind of response of the Syriza political party in Greece. My second update has to do with something, and I don't mean to be scary, but what can I do? My job is to tell you what's going on and not to censor it because it might frighten you. The Federal Reserve is the central bank of the United States. Its function is to control and manipulate the money system in this country, literally by creating money, printing it, simply adding to the bank accounts of banks so that they have more money to lend out, to spend, and also by controlling interest rates, another dimension of the monetary system. When the current crisis happened, the Federal Reserve had on its books a little less than $1 trillion worth of American government debt. Here's the way this works. When the Federal Reserve wants to increase the money supply, here's what it does. It goes to people and institutions that own debt of the United States, that have in the past lent money to the United States and gotten what's called a government bond or a government security to show that it's like an IOU that the government gives to the people who lend it money. Well, the Federal Reserve, which is basically another branch of the government set up in conjunction with banks in this country, they have the right to buy those treasury securities from the banks, from the insurance companies, from the large corporations, and from the wealthy people around the world who own them. And when the Federal Reserve does that, it can use freshly produced new money to do that. If you've ever wondered, where does the money come from that sits in everybody's wallets? It's the Federal Reserve that decides to produce it. And it injects it into the economy mainly by buying the debt of the United States government from whoever happens to own it. These days, because of the crisis, the Federal Reserve has been behaving unusually. It doesn't just buy the debt of the United States government. The Federal Reserve has been buying, particularly in recent months, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of mortgage-backed securities, those odd securities that mushroomed over the last 5 or 6 or 7 years of the housing boom in this new century, and many of which are of dubious value. Well, the Federal Reserve is buying them. And when it buys them, it prints new money with which to pay for them, so that the quantity of new money added can be measured by how much of these bonds the Federal Reserve has acquired. And here comes the scary number. Between September 2008 and today, January 2013, the holdings in the Federal Reserve went from $1 trillion to $3 trillion. That is, the Federal Reserve added $2 trillion worth of new additional money to the global economy. The hope was, never realized, the hope was that flooding the economy with this new money would give all kinds of people more money in their pocket, that they would spend that money, thereby creating business and thereby creating the jobs to produce what the money was spent on. It didn't happen. That's why we still have a recession. That's why we still have high unemployment. The money was used instead to fatten up the balance sheets of banks and large corporations and to speculate in the stock market, which has therefore revived, or as they like to say, recovered since the worst of the downturn in 2008 and 2009. Good news for shareholders. Good news for bank share owners. But for the mass of people, no. But here's the worst of it. Those $2 trillion are sitting there in the accounts of banks, corporations, and rich people making money off the rising prices of stock markets as they gamble there. Here's the danger. If that money begins to seep out of the banks, corporations, and stock market and move into real estate, land, apartments, and purchasing goods and services, we're going to have a sudden flood of money much larger than the available stock of goods and services that they want to buy with that money. And the result of that? Inflation, rising prices, a whole new kind of economic catastrophe lurking on the edges of where we are now. And if you're told when you understand this not to worry that the Federal Reserve will step in and take steps to neutralize the danger of inflation, even if you believe they can, and even if you believe they will, it takes them a long time. And we have plenty of evidence to see that the current crisis, now in its sixth year, was neither prevented nor offset nor reversed in the last 5 years by even the most extreme measures the Federal Reserve took. We will be watching the explosion of money in the United States in the months to come. All right, we now need to turn to my guest today, and I want to welcome to our program here, Jan Rehman. I'm going to introduce him fully, but I want to say hello to him and have you meet him as well.
Thank you for having me.
Jan is a professor who teaches philosophy and social theory at the Union Theological Seminary, a very old and well-established theological school in New York City. And he also teaches at the Free University in Berlin. He's written many books and articles. And the most recent, which will become available later this year, is called Theories of Ideology, and the publisher will be the well-known Brill Company. You may remember that he appeared on this program in an interview with his colleague Willie Baptist, because they together wrote a book called Pedagogy of the Poor, and that produced a very interesting interview here earlier. But today I've invited Jan Rehman because I want to discuss the impact, particularly on the American economy, but on American society in general, and perhaps more globally around the world, of that remarkable phenomena, Occupy Wall Street. It's a good year now that it exploded onto the American scene, so we have time to look back and think about it. My guest, Jan Rehman, is someone who studies it, who has published articles about it. He's involved with a German political party called the Die Linke and with its intellectual think tank called the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation that has also devoted a lot to looking at the Occupy Wall Street movement here in the United States. They even had a conference on it recently, and also to compare it to movements for social change, to movements against austerity that exist in Europe and beyond. And finally, I've asked Jan Rehman because he has a particular perspective I think you will find interesting. He applies the work in his own studies. He applies the work of a major 20th century social theorist named Antonio Gramsci. And so by final introduction to him, I want to say a few words about Antonio Gramsci. Very widely influential across many disciplines in the United States, in Europe, all over the world, people study the writings of Antonio Gramsci. He is arguably the most influential Italian social theorist, maybe ever, but certainly of the last 100 years or more. And you might be interested to know a little bit about his life. He comes from a very obscure place, the island of Sardinia, an island that is part of Italy, but offshore in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea. He grew up in a peasant family. He was very sickly. Indeed, he had a kind of a bent body all his life, a small bent man. Who tells a famous story that his parents didn't believe he was going to live, and true to the traditions of the little Sardinian town, in his early months, they had him sleep each night in a coffin because they expected him to die. You don't need an advanced degree in psychology to think about what it might mean to spend the early part of your life sleeping every day in a coffin. He went on to become an intellectual giant, far outdistancing his physical infirmities. There is today, for example, in Rome, the Gramsci Institute, one of the most important intellectual centers of thought in all of Italy. Less well known, because it frightens some folks, is the fact that Antonio Gramsci was for a long time the founder and the longtime head of the Italian Communist Party. And indeed, shortly after Benito Mussolini became a leader in Italy in the early 1920s. One of his first acts was to arrest and imprison Antonio Gramsci, who, as a communist leader and as a leading intellectual, was the sworn enemy of fascism as it was represented by Mussolini. Mussolini put him in jail, where he spent the rest of his life. They only let him out in 1937 when he was so ill that he had a very few months left to live, and he died. While he was in jail, he decided to think through what a revolution in Italy might mean. He produced a famous body of work, usually known as the prison notebooks, that were the product of his work there, and that's where his influence comes from. So I think you will find it interesting to see how someone applies this great theorist's work on something as urgent and topical as Occupy Wall Street and all it has meant. So, Jan, let's begin by having you tell us, if you can, what in the world is meant by a Gramscian approach or a Gramscian analysis of anything such as Occupy Wall Street.
Antonio Gramsci was the first theorist who systematically investigated the question of how a class society succeeds in establishing a hegemony, which means a general consensus that its rule is legitimate and beneficial. How can it maintain this consensus despite capitalism's obvious inherent irrationality, despite its recurring economic crisis, despite its polarization of rich and poor, despite its destruction of the environment? And Gramsci also asked how the lower classes could disrupt this imposed consensus, how oppositional movements could develop what he called a counter-hegemony, an attractive and appealing alternative to the powers that be. And I think that these are still the most important questions when we deal with a movement like Occupy Wall Street. A Gramscian approach can account for both Occupy Wall Street's strengths and weaknesses. It looks, for instance, at how the movement was able to disrupt the predominant ideological framework of U.S. capitalism, how it captured the imagination of many people that had not been involved in progressive politics before, how did it tap into people's common sense and frustration and discontent, and on the other hand, how can we understand the limits of the movement that blocked the construction of a political alternative and a sustainable counter-hegemony so far.
Good. Let's unpack that, as we say, a little bit. Let's begin by having you tell us how you think Occupy Wall Street was able to change the common sense of Americans, in the sense of how it changed the way they looked at the economic system they lived in, how it changed the way they understood it. And was that change deep? Did it change it in a profound way? Tell us how you think Occupy Wall Street worked its effects on people's consciousness.
Okay, to start out with, this achievement was certainly not stable so far, or is not stable so far, not a lasting one. But in order to appreciate the enormous achievements of the movement, we have to go back and compare what was before and what was after it started.
Good.
We have to remember that up to mid-September 2011, it seemed to be set in stone that the Tea Party, the only vibrant and expanding social movement in the U.S., and we all remember that when the Obama administration organized a huge bailout for the big banks and financial institutions, and then turned over economic policy to Larry Summers and Tim Geithner and so on, it created a huge frustration and discontent and dismantled its own social base. And since there was no leftist formation in any independent way, this terrain, this discontent was immediately occupied by the right-wing Tea Party movement, which tapped into that frustration and redirected it from, let's say, from Wall Street to Washington, against the government, against government's regulation, against government's taxes, and so on. It was pretty
carefully
successful.
Avoiding any critique of the economic system.
Sure, sure. Against the cultural elites instead of the economic elites, for instance.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah.
So liberals and leftists could not imagine that a mass movement like Occupy Wall Street could emerge and develop in such a short time. One month later compared to September, 2011. The hegemonic landscape has changed considerably. According to a poll of late October 2011, 43% of U.S. citizens agreed with the views of the Occupy Wall Street movement, compared to 9% approval ratings for Congress. Mm. So this was obviously a huge shift in a very, very short time period.
And it suggests, right, I mean, that the change in mentality must have been building implicitly or maybe even below the level of consciousness, so that this Occupy movement was able to bring it forward in people's minds, to make it legitimate, just the kind of Gramscian notions.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the main causes, there are many reasons why Occupy Wall Street was successful. I limit myself to just some of them. The first reason is that at the beginning, by occupying Zuccotti Park, the movement showed a combination of boldness, creativity, and inventiveness that captured the imagination. People could also see then in the following weeks that these folks actually had the courage, the chutzpah, to stay there, to persevere against all the odds. A second reason is that from the outset, Occupy Wall Street built relationships with community groups, with anti-poverty initiatives, with immigrant rights organizations, church communities, and so on, and not least with trade unions.
Right.
For example, it sent its activists to the headquarters of the telephone company Verizon to show solidarity with the communication workers' strike. And in response, several trade unions showed their solidarity with the movement as well and picked up slogans of the Occupy movement for their own struggles.
And it's quite clear for those who don't remember that the first failed attempt of Mayor Bloomberg to vacate Zuccotti Park was prevented when a ring of union members surrounded the park and confronted the mayor with a requirement to violently overthrow the unions that he needed for his political life to continue. Was a very important moment of solidarity that kept Zuccotti Park occupied by Wall Street for weeks beyond what would otherwise have been the case.
And I think this is due to a very clear anti-sectarian approach of Occupy Wall Street. And so they created relationships to other movement initiatives, relations of mutual reinforcement, one could say. And a third reason is that especially by their slogan, "We are the 99%, they created a new framework of unity, common belonging, that stood out against the long U.S. tradition of single issue movements.
And identity. Issues that kept away from the economics.
Yes, yes.
Whether they were anti-racism or anti-sexism or in favor of the environment, they were riven by debates, usually won by those who said, don't bring up the economic questions. It will hurt us. It will divide us. So Occupy Wall Street is absolutely extraordinary in putting the economic inequality and oppression right up front from the beginning.
Yes. I mean, I want to stress that all these subjects, ecology, racism, are very important subjects.
Absolutely.
This is not the point. The point is that identity politics is often based on a kind of distinction from each other. And I think that this slogan, "We are the 99%, created a completely new framework just by expressing an undeniable economic fact
of inequality
immediately confirmed by the Congressional Budget Office, namely that over the last 30 years, the top 1% more than doubled its share in the national income, whereas the other segments went down. And this is an enormous creativity to just translate that into a political slogan.
Jan, I want us to take our usual mid-program break. We've been talking with Jan Rehman. We've been talking about the extraordinary achievements and social and ideological impact of Occupy Wall Street. After the break, please stay with us. We're going to come back and talk about some of the problems and limits that a Gramscian analysis of Occupy Wall Street can bring forward for us to think about and learn from.
If we do it in, how about B flat? I can't wait for you to change your mind. I can't wait just making me go blind. Under the wall, drowning in your thoughtless, missing, cut off from it all. I don't know. Baby, for you, it's not that late. But as for me, don't know how much longer.
Well, Bob Dylan, as so often in his life, captures that basic question. I don't know how much longer I can wait. And that's not just about your personal life either. We're talking with Jan Rehman, a teacher at the Union Theological Seminary, as well as the Free University in Berlin. We're talking about Occupy Wall Street, and he is telling us about his thinking and research as to what its impact was. That's what we discussed before the musical break. And now we want to talk about some of its limits. So let me begin, Jan, by saying what everybody says, which is it is much less in the public eye, much less in the media, much less in evidence in our lives today than it was in those final months of 2011 and even into early 2012. So some of its momentum is lost. It certainly still exists, and it's active in a variety of ways. In the New York area, it was stunning what the Occupy movement was able to do in helping people recover from Sandy, the hurricane that we had here, where it did more good than most of the city agencies that should have been doing the work. But tell us, how do you see the limits, the things that Occupy Wall Street did that teach us things it ought to have done, or at least that the next incarnation, the next upsurge, ought to remember to do?
Yes. Before I point out the limit, I would like to stress that Occupy Wall Street has not vanished after the clearing of Zuccotti Park. It lives on in many actions and campaigns, for instance, against student debts and foreclosures, Occupy Our Homes, and so on. And you cited the example of Occupy Sandy. I think what is so difficult for the movement is to find another point of coalitions and of visibility.
Now that they've been pushed out of the park.
Sure, true. And the police takes care of that. That is not to be happening again.
Yes, the mayors seem to have been nicely coordinated from Washington to do that all at the same time.
Exactly.
To keep the parks clear. I cannot miss an opportunity to remind our listeners of what the mayor of New York said. The mayor of New York said he had to do this, violently bring bulldozers in and destroy the camp of Occupy, because of his deep commitment to cleanliness. You see, the park wasn't clean enough. This is the mayor who presides over the filthiest subway system on this planet and has throughout his three administrations. He doesn't care about what they look like or their dilapidation. He's interested in cleanliness, but in a remarkably selective way. So, Jan, I interrupted you. My apologies. No. Tell us about the limits.
I think what's missing in the U.S. is an independent leftist formation that is both open to the many different approaches in the social movements and sufficient coherent to bring these differences together and to translate them into a convincing alternative. And you can see that when you compare the situation in the U.S. and in Europe. In several European countries, there is an intense and productive interplay between social movements, trade unions, and leftist parties, instead of the old splits and animosities. There are more and more relations of mutual reinforcement. And this applies, for instance, to Spain, where the Occupy movement of the Indignados strongly influences the strategy of the trade unions. In the meantime, the trade unions became much more combative and militant. It also reactivated the membership of the leftist party coalition Izquierda Unida, which, on the other hand, opened its electoral lists for movement activists and more than doubled its electoral votes. And in Greece especially, we can see that there were, for a long time, strong and combative social movements organizing huge demonstrations against the imposed austerity politics with no direct impact, however, until the leftist party coalition Syriza succeeded in assembling the impulses of the movements into a coherent political alternative, which, as you mentioned, garnered 27% in the last elections in June 2012, and now, according to the polls, has even more, about 30%. So social movements and leftist parties have learned from each other. The parties do not longer claim to represent the movement, but define themselves as more or less connective parties. And more activists in the movement understand that they need allies in the parliamentary system as well. and that a general refusal of party politics helps only the most conservative and reactionary parties.
Yeah, because they're left alone since the alternatives stay out of the political arena.
Exactly, yeah.
So your argument is it is a limit of the Occupy not to have explored or pursued or opened itself to some attempts at least at a creative political formation project as well.
Yes, it has not mustered the will and the capacity so far to initiate its own autonomous progressive organization of a new type based on networks, based on radical democracy and so on, a kind of connective party, which doesn't mean necessarily an electoral party. And I think this is one of the reasons why it was not possible so far to transform Occupy Wall Street's momentary disruption of neoliberal hegemony into a more sustainable, lasting counter-hegemony.
All right, this is wonderful. Now, let's take it the next step. One of the most persistent criticisms of Occupy Wall Street, both when it was in its heyday of exploding onto the American scene and getting the kind of mass support that your poll numbers show, and then later when it had ebbed in terms of its surging importance in America, one of the most consistent criticisms was, what was its program? Or it didn't articulate a clear program, as if a movement has from the very beginning to have all the answers to how to proceed. Without going to that extreme and rehearsing that criticism, which I think was pretty well refuted and pushed away, there is still the question, are there concrete or tangible ways that you think Occupy might translate all that it achieved into a more lasting impact? You've mentioned the political formation, but are there positive goals it could articulate, and what might they be to give itself even greater impact and to create a lasting framework?
Yeah. So I'm not advocating a new laundry list of demands. That's not my point. But just let me take this one example. The the claim of radical direct democracy and consensus principle is one of the characteristics of Occupy Wall Street, and I think it was a very important experience. But on the other hand, I think it should not be idolized as the only way to go. These are valuable starting points, but they need to be translated. They need to be concretized into projects of economic democracy. In my understanding, Occupy Wall Street is already a movement for economic democracy because it articulates...
Certainly includes that. Yes.
It expresses the fundamental contradiction between democracy and capitalism. But it does not work. It has not yet worked on economic democracy in an explicit way. And I think it would be good to do that. The concept.
Let me interrupt you, Jan, because I work on this, as you know. I also was struck with the enormous energy and creativity and originality of their demands for democratic ways of, for example, of disposing of park space in a city, of disposing of the entire urban landscape. They tied beautifully into the right to the city and all that, movements that want a democratic way to shape the political life of the community. The interesting question then becomes, doesn't that partner logically with a demand for democratically controlling the workplace too, and not just the residential or urban space within which workplaces occur?
Yes, in my view, this is
a crucial kind of next step.
Yes, a key question. I think without economic democracy, there's no real political democracy in society. Without economic democracy, there's no way to overcome the wild chase for profit that determines and alienates our lives. Without economic democracy, there's no chance for an ecological transformation, because an ecological transformation only becomes real if we really change the way we produce, what we produce, how we consume.
And what drives our productive
decisions. Exactly. And so One of the advantages of the concept of economic democracy is that it drew the lessons of both state, bureaucratic state socialism in Eastern Europe and Western social democracy in the West, because both of them did not change the fundamental power relations in the workplace. They did not build up workers' self-directed enterprises. And I think it's no wonder that economic democracy is such a taboo in capitalist ideologies. It is more carefully hidden, more carefully evaded than most of the sexual taboos, right, even in America. And I think we need to break this taboo and create a new and appealing alternative project of democratic and ecological socialism. And I think that spelling out, concretizing economic democracy is a key element to redefine what such an alternative could look like.
Wonderful conclusion to a discussion of Occupy, since you're basically arguing that Occupy Wall Street took a major step in precisely that direction, and that one of the ways to honor that step is to take it another step. And in a sense, you've suggested where that could go. Jan, I wish, as always, that we had more time. Let's do this again in the future. Thank you very, very much for sharing your Gramscian analysis with us.
Thank you very much.
In the time that remains today, I want to respond to two sets of questions that you have sent in. One, and I want to name Gary Fitzgerald because he was the person who sent it in and allowed us to use his name. He wanted me to spell out how the current education systems, I'm assuming he's thinking of the Western Europe and the United States, or perhaps just the United States, how the current education system serves a capitalist organization of the workplace, and how it would have to be different if we had workplaces in which workers directed their own enterprises. And I think that's a wonderful question. And let me try very quickly to give you an answer. In the United States, which is the country I know best, but I think this applies elsewhere, there are a host of goals and institutions that educate workers. What's wanted of most workers is that they be highly skilled in some narrow specialization, that they know how well to do some specific task, something in the division of labor inside a store, an office, or a factory. They should be good at some particular task, which they are then asked to do over and over again for basically the entirety of their lives. Number two, they're supposed to be disciplined. They're supposed to work hard and not be distracted by anything other than the work task. Third, they are supposed to follow orders. They're supposed to be able to understand and follow what other people above them in the hierarchy tell them to do. And we have institutions that train the mass of our people to do that. We have our public schools, primary, secondary public schools. We have our community colleges. We have our for-profit colleges. It's an exploding new sector in the United States. And we have a great large portion of our public universities that do that, that teach skills that are more and more narrowly specialized, that emphasize discipline and emphasize following orders. They don't just teach people how to work. They teach people to accept being told what to do on the job. And then we have an education system that trains other people very differently. We have what I would call the elite private and public institutions, those that cost the most, those with the great reputations, those which represent what in the United States passes for the preservation of modern civilization. And they train a completely different group of people in a completely different set of skills. They're supposed to cultivate your imagination. They're supposed to cultivate a broad group of interests. They're supposed to help you build very useful connections with other similarly elite-trained people. They're supposed to build in you a confidence that you are the cream of the crop, the top of the heap, the people who were born to run the show. Wow. You're supposed to come along with the capacity to make difficult decisions, drawing on a wide range of relevant factors, and put them together. You're supposed to be a director of what's going on. Well, that's the way we organize our education. That's one of the reasons why families are so desperate to get their children into the right school so that they can make it into the upper one and not be left languishing where the vast majority are. If you had a system that was different, that required of every worker not only to do his or her particular task in an enterprise, but also to be an equal democratic member of the governing board that makes all the decisions, you could not allow such an education system. Every worker would have to learn the skills of decision-making and judgment. Every worker would have to have the confidence that he or she has learned the skills which, together with experience, can allow you to make directing decisions. If we want an egalitarian sharing of education, really making education available to all, one of the prerequisites would be a transition of our economic system from the capitalist top-down hierarchical system we have to one in which workers' self-direction requires a very different kind of educational system. And it is something that people who are interested in equality or even just plain quality education ought to think about. We have been unable to do that. We have a highly stratified education system. Center City schools strapped for money, barely able to teach discipline. Long ago have given up on real education. And all the rest of it. Those are products in part of an economic system that does not allow the mass of people the control, the direction, the decision making that is left to a tiny elite. And if you do that in your workplace, that's the education system you get. My second response to your questions was to talk about current examples of workplaces in which workers do direct their own activity. And the reason I want to do this is not just to respond to your questions, but I want to get you away, if any of you are still there, from looking upon the notion of workers running their own enterprises as some utopian dream of something that could happen in a distant future. No. Workers running their own enterprise have been around for hundreds of years. They're around today. So I am starting today a program in which I'm going to talk to you about various ones of them from time to time so you become aware of them. Today I'm going to begin with a famous one. Back in 2008, a perfectly well-run and good factory in Chicago called Republic Windows and Doors was closed by the company that owned it. They had decided they could make more money in some other way, and so they decided to close the factory, to lay off all the workers, to create yet new economic problems for Chicago, which already has a lot of those problems. And the workers were left utterly in the lurch. They even refused to pay workers the wages, the back pay, the severance pay that they had been contractually obligated to do. The workers, to their credit, fought back. Another company was brought in, and it tried to run the factory, but it didn't do a much better job than the first capitalist in keeping it going. So by 2011, it looked like it was the end for this company, for this job, for these workers. But then, the 20-odd workers who worked there making modern, energy-efficient windows and doors decided to set up a business on their own. The workers would take over. They would reorganize it instead of a capitalist enterprise with shareholders and a board of directors telling everybody what to do. The workers themselves would become a worker self-directed enterprise. They would raise the money. They looked around for help. They got help from two very interesting sources. The United Electrical Workers, a very old union here in the United States, was farsighted enough to say, okay, in addition to our strategy of helping workers bargain with employers, we can also do something else as a union, and that is help workers to become their own bosses. And they helped these workers do exactly that. And another organization, just as important, whose name I want to give you, it's called The Working World, is an organization that has had years of experience in Latin America, helping workers there set up enterprises. So guess what? The New Era Corporation, the New Era Windows Cooperative, has now entered into existence. The jobs have been preserved. The work is being done. Chicago has a lower unemployment because of it. They're specializing in green windows and doors and hoping that the city of Chicago's initiatives, under pressure from ecological groups, to move in the direction of green building will mean growth for this cooperative that can make more workers into co-ops. If you're interested in learning about how this enterprise functions and understanding its history, please visit democracyatwork.info, where there are many examples, including New Era Windows, for you to see how this is a practical reality in the United States today. And in the future, we'll be talking about such examples in other countries as well as the United States. Thank you very much for listening to Economic Update. Thank you again, Jan Rehman, for joining us. And I hope I will talk with you again next week.
Going to mine, won't be mine. One of these days, babe, a morning droning, babe. Try, try, won't be long, long. Thing gonna change. Sometime in the middle of the night, I get so lonely, so lonely.